Hi, everybody. My name's Jeannie Case. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jeannie.
And, wait a minute. Through God's grace, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and strong sponsorship, I've been sober since March 1st, 1981. I'll play with that stuff all the way through if I don't put it down there. Last night, right before I went upstairs, somebody said, I hope you sleep well. I said, I never have any trouble sleeping. So last night, I was up on the hour, every single hour. I prayed before I went to bed, you know, and God answered my prayer, and my whole life was like flashing before my eyes. It would take hours, though, so we won't do that, Lee. Anyway, I'm not from the Pacific group. It was just because there were two of them last night, I guess. My home group is Giant East 4th Street, which is not on East 4th Street. It's now Giant, but it wasn't when they named it that. And it meets on Wednesday nights in Newport, Kentucky. We've moved it around a few times, but it stays the same people. And it's real special to me. And a lot of those people are here, if you're all wondering why there's cheering. Which is nice. It's nice. It's nice to go someplace. I don't know. I used to. I think I needed a Valium to go to my home group. I hated it. Every week I'd call somebody up and say, I'm not going back there again. And because nobody acted right. You know, they didn't do what they were supposed to do, and they did do what they weren't supposed to do. And if you spoke to me, I didn't like it. And if you didn't speak to me, I didn't like it. And if you spoke to her, I didn't like it. And, you know, we always have to really go through hours after the meeting, you know, talking about everybody. And, so I thought, I would always call somebody and say, I'm not going this week. My sponsor finally told me, Jeannie, you have to grow up somewhere. And so I kept going, and that's what happened. And those people are really special to me. I was talking to Sally yesterday, and, they don't even have to speak. We don't even have to speak to each other. Just seeing each other across the room, you just know that that person's glad you're there. You're glad they're there. And it's just okay then. It's a real special thing. I don't know how Alcoholics Anonymous works, which is good. If I could understand God, we'd all be in big trouble. I come from a family of drunks, which was a really good thing because nobody tried to interfere with my drinking. You know, we were all too busy drinking to interfere with each other's drinking. And I feel sorry for my kids. I mean, the minute they take a drink, we're like on them. You know, you need treatment. And that's not what happened. You know, I got to actually do it all, you know. I mean, not that it was good, but I got to do it all firsthand. I like firsthand knowledge. Evidently, I do because I insist on it all the time. Yeah, I don't know. It was fun. It was a really good childhood. Now, when I got here, I would have told you it was hell. My perception, have you ever, I don't know if they have it in the newspaper here. I thought of this last night when I was thinking. They're on the comic page. They have books of these things, too. They put them at doctor's offices where you're bored, you know. And they're pictures, they're computer images that are all the same thing, over and over, repeats. But then if you put them right by your eyes and you move them out slowly, you get to see this other picture in there. And that's pretty much what my life was like. You know, all I saw was all this stuff. You know, I couldn't see really what happened till after I'd been sober for a long time. They say you can't change the past. Mine's changed a lot since I got here. You know, I would have told you my father was mean. My mother was mean. My brothers and sisters were mean. And they probably were, but I was mean too. And, I could always tell you more about them than I would about me. I was very observant of other people's behavior, not at all observant of my own. I could step on your toe 100 times. And if you stepped on mine, I'd run tell somebody you stepped on my toe. It wasn't until I got to AA and people, you know, like home group and stuff, where I'd do that and somebody'd say, Jeannie, you were stamping on his feet all night long. And I'd say, I was? No wonder he stepped on your toe. He wanted you to leave him alone. And looking back today, it was a really good upbringing. There were, you know, animals and places to go and be by yourself and plenty of room and, like I said, lots of booze to steal. And I had a really good time. I was strange from the beginning, just like we all are, listening to people's leads last night. I remembered stuff that was strange about me. You know, when I was in first, I wouldn't go to school, first of all, and they finally had to tell me that they would put me in jail if I didn't go to school. That's the only reason I went to school, was because they told me in kindergarten that the truant officer, I wouldn't go to kindergarten. They said, you have to go this year or they'll put you in jail, so I went. But then in first grade, you know how you grow plants for your mother on Mother's Day? In a little milk carton with dirt and all that. Mine was the only one that didn't grow. And I turned everybody else's upside down on the windowsill. Now, I don't remember doing that. Someone told me that later. But that's the kind of stuff that I would do. And see, I don't know that I'm like that. I had no idea that I'm like that. Till I was, you know, probably, well, I was going to say 5, but probably 10 years sober. I didn't even know I was like that. And I went through life with that kind of attitude. I drank as soon as I could. It never occurred to me not to drink. Nobody ever said don't drink. I was probably in teenage years sometime. I don't know. At that time, the exciting thing to do was go to the drive-in with the boys, and I wanted the, you know, Schlitz or Colt 45. I didn't want burger beer or some dumb, you know, icky stuff. I wanted the real thing that would get me there right away, right off the bat. I never minded throwing up. I never minded falling down. I thought that's what men were for, to hold you up. Dates especially. I don't know where I got that idea. I watched a lot of movies on TV. I still watch the same ones over and over again. My husband says, we've seen this movie 14 times. I said, I know, isn't it wonderful? It's exciting to me. I don't know why. You know, all the old, they all had drunks in them, the ones I really liked. So I drank, and it was fun, and I didn't try to hide it or anything. That was the nice thing about our family. You didn't have to try to hide it because everybody drank. And I never stood out, I didn't think. I never stood out. My drinking never stood out. The other really good thing about being, I had 6 brothers and sisters, and somebody was always getting in trouble. The older ones especially really helped me out. They were always wrecking cars and things like that. And that takes all the, you know, light off of you. Your parents are so busy paying attention to this one over here that's really screwing up that you can get by with a lot of stuff. And I did that for years and pointed my finger at my older brother and sister and said, you know, they are really bad. I don't know. Well, you should have been up with me last night. I don't know if it's over or not. I don't know. I went away to college. I do know that I was an alcoholic by the time I was in my early 20s. Looking back on it, after being in these rooms and listening to a lot of people stand at podiums like this and try to tell their stories, I found out that's definitely when I crossed that invisible line or whatever you want to call it. I drank as much as I could. I was blacking out by then. I was passing out a lot by then. My primary purpose in life by then was drinking. I wasn't able to be around other people comfortably unless I had a lot to drink. I immediately found the people in Chicago that drank like I did. I don't know how we do that, but I did it. I felt very lonely and miserable. The biggest problem that I had at that time was I was 21 years old and everybody, you know, you're graduating from college and everybody's saying, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I mean, I've never known what I wanted to be when I grew up. I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I was not good at long-range planning. You know, my goal was to go to the bar that night. And I usually accomplished my short-term goals. I had no idea what I wanted to be. And I was at school with all these wonderful women, and some of them I'm still in touch with today, which is unusual because I usually burnt people off pretty quick. I don't have a whole lot of friends from the past. That was not a problem when I got sober, to leave my old friends. I didn't have any. And my husband was hoping I would leave. They all knew what they wanted to be. They were studying to be that. Today they are lawyers, and they are doctors, and they are speech therapists, and they are interior designers. I mean, it was a whole spectrum of stuff. Today I know that I was doing what I needed to do to be what I was going to be when I grew up. I was drinking. And, you know, here I am. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I was doing what I was doing. You know, I mean, I needed to do those things. They were wonderful women. They really were. And I never thought I was, you know, it embarrassed me not to know what I wanted to be. I was going to be a teacher, so I got my teaching certificate, but I was so afraid being in a classroom with teenagers that I never, ever got any further than with that. I mean, I was terrified. I had this suspicion that they knew more than I did, which they probably did. Also, I thought, you can't meet men teaching high school. I mean, you know, who are you going to meet? They're all going to be teenagers. I can't do this. So I started working for a bank when I got back to Cincinnati, and I drank. I drank in bars, and now I was drinking in bars alone where I didn't know very many people. And that got pretty ugly pretty fast. I was pretty pathetic by then. I thought the bouncers were my boyfriends because they were there every night. And, I mean, I really thought that they were there to see me. I did. I thought they were there because I was going to be there. And, you know, I never met any men in the bars but the bouncers. And they had to be there every night, and so did I. You know, it was a job. I needed to be there every night. A friend of mine from high school introduced me to this guy that I ended up marrying. And he was not an alcoholic. Now, he came from a long, I mean, his family was a very ill family, we found out years later. But he is very attracted to alcoholics. The thing I like about him is we got divorced and he went into alcoholism counseling, and I thought he missed me, you know. He needed hundreds of drunks to replace me. He was dying to get rid of me. And I was really fat by the time I got to AA, and he also counsels fat women. And I thought, you know, he really misses me. Anyway, I met him and married him, and you know, I really thought that was going to be the trick. I wasn't drinking when I met him. I was able still at that point to stop for a good reason. The good reason was to lose weight to find a man, and that's what I did. I found a man. I wasn't drinking. I was skinny. He was very shocked later to find out that this was not who I was, because I started drinking again right away. And those were in the days when they had liter bottles. You know, they would put liter bottles of wine. It became the fad at some point on the tables, you know. And I loved it because then you didn't have to just have that one bottle that you knew was going to be empty and order another one. They kept filling those liter things, and I could drink as much as I wanted. He did not like to take me out by the time this marriage was over because I was always fight with the waitress because she was too slow. I would be belligerent in the restaurant and embarrass him. He also did not want me to eat or drink, so you can't go anywhere. It was not a marriage made in heaven, I'll put it that way. My sponsor later told me, Jeannie, the best things that will ever happen to you will be things that you have nothing to do with. I try not to have plans today. That way, really wonderful surprises happen. When I have plans, we're getting ready for a really bad time. Really bad time. That took years for me to learn. Sober, it really did. Fast forward. I did end up getting married. I had two children. I have a daughter who's 19 years old today and a son who is 17, 16. I always wanted him to be older than he was. I still do. I mean, I remember when he was 6 telling somebody he was 8 because I really wanted him to go to this camp. And this woman looked at me and she said, he's 8? And I said, yeah. And she looked at him and she said, how old are you? And he said, 6. And I was like, I don't know. I thought he was 8. I wanted to get through with this, you know. Kids is something, you know, sort of like staying sober. You never get through with it. It's always there. Once you have them, you have them. And I had them for the wrong reasons. I had them because the marriage didn't fix me, and I thought that having babies makes you feel like this whole woman, and this, you know, makes you feel like a tired woman is what it makes you feel like. And I immediately did not like it. I was mad at the people that told me how wonderful it was, and it was just one more thing that didn't work. You know, the college education didn't work, the husband didn't work, being thin didn't work, babies didn't work, all kinds of stuff didn't work. My daughter, she's been sober for, I'll say a year, getting close, but she's been sober for a year in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she just moved into an apartment, and she thinks it is just the most wonderful place in the world. And her stepsister and I went over to see it. We went to buy her some things and take them back to her, and my daughter Tracy kept saying, get antibacterial, everything we bought, get antibacterial. Anyway, and I'm thinking, why does this child want to, why does she think this apartment is so wonderful? Because it isn't. And I realized her whole life, I had her living in places like that and didn't even know it. We always bought these terrible rundown houses, and then we were going to fix them up. You know, I think it was like my life. I had this terrible, I wished I could fix it up. We were always living in, you know, with one sink and plaster dust, and they probably have lead poisoning and everything else. But that's just what we did. It kept me busy, and I could stay at home and drink, and I liked it. So she thinks this is a wonderful place, and she's lived in places like that all her life. I can understand why. We did that, and finally what happened was one of those people in my family, you know, everybody gets so mad at their families, and our families are so sick, and one of these people in my family came to Alcoholics Anonymous. She did it herself, which I could never have done, and she brought me with her. And if she hadn't, I wouldn't be standing up here today. It's that simple. I never went anywhere without her for a couple of, quite a while, a long time. I was sober for a long time, and I wouldn't even tell you my name. And then you'd start saying, you're so-and-so's sister, and then I would get mad at you because you didn't know my name, but I wouldn't tell it to you. And then I got resentful at her because you knew her name. And it you know, it was not fun. But anyway, she brought me to AA. We went out and had a beer. She said she thought she was an alcoholic. She'll tell you herself that she had to start doing 12-step work before she could ever get sober. She would go home and drink after every meeting. And since she started, when the moment she started bringing me to meetings, she didn't drink anymore when she went home. And I didn't either. I haven't had a drink since the first meeting I went to. Now, I have no idea I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what it meant to be alcoholic. We did know I drank a lot. we knew I was very miserable. By then, I had started the rounds of the doctors and the psychiatrists, and, you know, I was always working on the wrong problem. I'm fat, so we live in Fort Thomas, Kentucky now, and there's this fat doctor over there. I mean, I had no idea where Fort Thomas, Kentucky was at that time, but I was willing to drive over there to find this fat doctor. Of course, the answer to being fat is don't eat, and I never could get that. You know, I always thought it was something else, like fix me. And they just would say, don't eat so much. I'd say, oh, darn. And I knew there was a different answer. But I was working on that kind of problem, and then the marriage was just terrible. I was always thinking it was something other than it was. I never, ever believed it was me. But I came to the meetings, and I started crying. Now, I was wearing maternity dresses at the time because I was very heavy, and this woman came in, and she said, oh, are you going to have a baby? And the baby had been born a year before that. I was ticked. So don't ever ask anybody if they're going to have a baby. I learned that lesson. I still don't like the girl. I haven't seen her in a while, but I don't care if I ever do. And I cried, and I didn't work the steps. I was going to a 12 and 12 meeting. We were reading about the steps. There were things in there that I begged to differ on. You know, things like, if you're upset, there's something wrong with you. I did not like that one. That really bothered me. And then there was one I really liked that said something about how sick the other people were, and I liked that one. I always thought that was true. And I don't know. I went to these meetings for a couple years, and I'd only go You know, they say don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. So I thought if you just didn't drink, you know, that's okay. If you can just not drink, don't do anything else. So I didn't drink, and every now and then I would get insane and go to a meeting with my sister, only with my sister. And so I drove, you know, like 20 miles to go to meetings with my sister because I couldn't go by myself. I remember there were people in those meetings. My sponsor and I would talk about anonymity, and he would say, what it means, Jeannie, is that there's the people that help you won't even know they're helping you, and you will help people you don't even know you're helping. I thought, what? I mean, I thought this was all about, you know, you help me, and I'll tell you how. And let me tell you what I need. And those people I remember today that would say things, you know, I would be crying and saying, you know, by then I had been sober long enough that I was realizing, you know, that I needed to find a different problem or something. And I said, well, if you guys weren't fat, I mean, if you guys were fat, you'd understand how I feel because I'm fat. And of course you can be happy being sober, but I can't because I'm fat. And, you know, they would just say things to me that would really, I'd say, nobody ever says hello to me. And this woman looked at me and she said, did you ever think maybe you were self-centered? Well, that really made me mad. All the way home, I was mad about that. I'm a lot of things, but I'm not self-centered. Now, I had not obviously touched this. Why read that? I was reading things like The Alcoholic Family and trying to figure out whether I was the hero or the lost child or the... There was one that had a graph in it, and I was too brain dead to read this graph. That ticked me off. I never read any more of that because this graph totally confused me. But I was trying to figure out for years at the beginning of my sobriety why I was an alcoholic, and I guess that the next step in that is if I find out why, I won't be anymore. It took a long time to realize that finding out why was kind of a waste of time because you're still going to be one when you get done. Who cares why? I don't know. Lots of things like that happened. I cried all the time. People to this day in Cincinnati remember me crying at meetings. I didn't cry quietly. I sobbed. I sobbed. And if I really got upset, I sobbed. Nobody ever said, why are you crying, Jeannie? I wish someone would have asked because I could have told you. My father was mean and he was a drunk and my mother was a drunk and she wasn't getting sober and I had all the stuff ready for you if you asked why, but nobody asked why. Today I can look back and realize I wasn't drinking and I wasn't doing anything else to help myself, and that is a very sad place to be. I mean, I missed alcohol bad. I was grieving, if you will. I was grieving it badly. I don't know. There's so many things that have happened. When I was said at the beginning, I'm not a member of Pacific Group. You know, the idea of anonymity, Clancy helped me so much, and he has no idea he ever did. I hope he's not in here. I didn't see him earlier. I hope he's still in bed. Anyway, he helped me so much. He was talking in Columbus one time about, I don't know, 10 or 11 years ago, and it was just a one-day thing, and it was at the university, and I had this resentment against this girl in my home group because I thought she did something unforgivable. She went out with this guy I thought I wanted to go out with. And, of course, see, I was divorced by now. I forgot to say I got divorced. I did get divorced. That was interesting. We went to counseling, and they kept saying, what are you going to do? And I'd go back to my sponsor and say, what am I going to do? And he'd say, don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. So I told that to this counselor, and this man just said, and what else? Hell, I don't know. And finally I said it to this different counselor. I said something like, why don't we try a separation? And this guy was out of here. Yes, that's a great idea. Why don't we? And he's been gone ever since. And it really is the best thing that ever happened to me, you know, and to him. Anyway, so I had this resentment against this woman, and I mean, I hated her. I mean, you know what that hate is? That really, when you know someone has definitely interfered with God's will for you. Like that's possible. And I didn't have much of a concept of God at the time, you know. And so there she was. She was sitting in a clubhouse. I went over to the clubhouse. and I had to sit at that table because there wasn't anybody else there except for her and these other people. And we, I don't even remember how it happened. I must have done the inventory. I must have known I needed to make the amendment and decided not to. And so we ended up driving all the way to Columbus to hear Clancy. Everybody said, you got to go hear Clancy. He's crazy. He's wonderful. So we drove to Columbus together, and I got to make amends to this girl, and I found out that what I thought was God's will wasn't much fun for her either. But anyway, my idea didn't work for her either. You know, I remember we met him at the door of this place he was supposed to stay. We were the only ones there. No one else was around. We got to carry his suitcases. I was his bags. We thought it was really neat at the time. You know, we were 5 minutes sober, and here's this guy who's been sober a long time. I was really honored to carry his bags up to his room. Another time, I went to this conference in Texas. I was supposed to be all excited. This is how we know. I don't know. The way I know it's God's will is I say the prayer and go on and forget about it. The man that sponsored me, his sponsor's name was Wino Joe, and he was from Texas. And he had a collection of big books. And he had different numbers in the front, printings and editions. There's first, second, third edition, and however. This is the 49th printing of the, what edition? I don't know. But anyway, there was one he was missing, so I don't know how many big books he had, and there was one he was missing, and my sponsor came back from Texas, and he said to all of us that he sponsored, I would really love to find this book for him to make his collection complete. So I remember, walking around my apartment. By then I was in an apartment with my kids and me, and I just said, God, I'd really like to find this thing if I could, It's like finding a needle in a haystack. I mean, where are you going to find the? It was printed during World War II, I think, or something. So I'm going to my regular Friday night meeting. I had $20 with me because I was in Kentucky and I was going to buy cigarettes. Well, the only reason I carried money was to get me something. And I'm going over there and I stop at this bookstore just because I happen to see it. I never noticed it before. And I go in and I say, do you have any old copies of Alcoholics? Mom, we got that one old, and we opened it up and that's sure as hell, that's what it was. The exact edition, the exact printing. I mean, I was shaking. I put it in this paper bag, and when I got to the meeting, I never said anything. I just dropped it in front of my sponsor. And I got to go to Texas with him to give this book to Wino Joe. Well, I was very I'm telling you, I was 8 years sober probably. 6 or 8 years sober. Most self-centered person you would ever want to meet, and had no idea that that was my problem. I really thought it was something else. I was still like, what's the matter with me? And my sponsor would say, I don't know, Jeannie, but your new people will let you know. And I only work with new people because I had no other choice. That's another story. Anyway, we got down there, and it was this horrible ice storm. We got there early, but it was all this ice. I mean, nobody was going anywhere. And Clancy got to Dallas and he couldn't go any further. The idiot rented a car and went out on these icy roads and drove all the way there to get there. And that impressed me. That's the only thing I really, I don't remember seeing the big book collection. I was not at all impressed. I was too busy thinking about myself. But I do remember that somebody was willing. He wasn't going back to California. He was going to make it there if he had to walk. And that made an impression on me. There's things like that. I mean, so who knows what any of us do that's going to make an impression on another person. I guess the way people put that is to say, you may be the only big book somebody sees. And so I'm not a member of the Pacific Group, and Clancy's not my sponsor, but he's helped me a lot. And I'm sure that all of us can look around these rooms or remember back the things that were really critical, that happened at really critical times. What time is it? Okay. Working with new people, that was really a trip. I would call people up and tell them what the matter was that day. It was, the problem du jour. And I was talking to my sister, because I usually burdened her with this stuff, and she said, there's a new person at this hospital, go pick her up and take her to a meeting. And of course, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to talk about my problem. And she hung up on me, which really upset me, because she was about the only one left talking to me by then. And so I went over to this hospital, and I picked this woman up. And at I don't notice it anymore. I don't really think it happens that a lot anymore. But at the time, you had to sign the people out. So I had to put my name down on a piece of paper that I was taking Dixie with me. So I wrote it down, I'm taking Dixie with me. So we get out in the hall, and Dixie has this cup of ice water. She throws it up against the wall. And I just stood there, and I didn't go clean it up. I was so proud of myself. I mean, that's what I normally, you know, I cleaned for like the first 2 years I was sober. I cried and cleaned. But I knew I didn't think I had to clean that up. So I just stood in there, and we went downstairs. The minute we got out the door of the hospital, she took off. And I didn't run after her. I was so proud of myself. I mean, what am I, you know, it really, I understood. What are you going to do? Don't get between a drunk and a drink. You'll get killed. And do pin her down and say, you're staying sober today because I said so. So I went back in the hospital and called upstairs, and they all knew she was going to run away. They all hollering up and down the halls, Dixie ran, Dixie ran. But I was willing to go get her. I saw her a couple years later. She, I guess, was in the same hospital. There was a place to buy beer right near the hospital, and she had two or three bottles of beer and was heading for the park across the street. And I said, hi, Dixie, and she just kept going. You know, these people, those are the kind of people that have helped me, and she doesn't know she helped me. I did an institution meeting because my sister and a friend of hers took me to this hospital and sat me down in this room with the chief psychiatrist of this hospital. And he's telling me how alcoholism, you know, is not complicated by other disorders. Other disorders are complicated by alcoholism. And I'm sitting there saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's saying, really, these people are very depressed, and this is wrong with them, and that's wrong with them, and they drink a little. But we want you to do this meeting. And I didn't argue. I just said, okay, and I went and did this meeting. I did a meeting there Thursday nights for years. Had no idea what I was doing. Still thought I was helping other people. People talk about getting self-worth. That's all I had was self-worth. I'm the only person I ever cared about in my life. And so it was not a problem of self-worth. It was a problem of self-centeredness. Anyway, so I went there and did this meeting. And I can see their faces today. And not one of them is sober. One lady taught me about alcoholism. I was reading the book by now, but I still didn't understand what I was reading. She said, I drank last night and the nurse wanted to know why. And I said, well, did you tell her why? I was, you know, getting ready to hear the reason, because I always had reasons. And I didn't know that we drank because we were, I mean, I didn't understand that yet, that we drink because we're alcoholic. And she said, well, yeah, I told her I drank because I'm an alcoholic. And I said, oh, that's right, that is why we drink. This other guy was a minister, very sad minister, and he was in and out over the years. He was in and out of the psych ward. And he would sit there, and we would talk, and he would at least sit up for that part, and he would say, well, I used to be an alcoholic, and I don't drink anymore, and I've never gone to AA. And he's sitting in the meeting, of course, because there's nothing else to do on the psych ward. And and he said that over and over again to me for years, that he used to be an alcoholic. So I got to see what happens if you think that you're going to used to be, if you think you're not going to be one anymore. Then you get to be a psychiatric patient. Well, that's really, it's what happened to the poor guy. It's what happened to the poor guy. The day that I stopped doing that meeting, I gave it to somebody else to do. They were changing everything, and I got mad about it, of course, and I thought, well, I'm not doing this meeting here anymore because they're changing the rules. So I gave it to someone else to do, and I was walking down the corridor of that hospital, and I knew without a shadow of a doubt that those people had kept me sober all those years, that I had done nothing for them at all. That they had taught me what it means to be an alcoholic. They had taught me that what Alcoholics Anonymous does for us. They don't know that. I don't know where they are today. They helped me immeasurably. I could tell you hundreds of stories about that. The people that I sponsor today, I didn't even like. I mean, I didn't want to sponsor anybody, especially if they were pretty. I definitely didn't want to sponsor them. My sponsor would tell me over and over again, because I would always be really burdened with the past stuff, and he would say, he would read the part in the book about cling to the thought that in God's hands the dark past is the greatest asset you have. With it you can avert death and misery for others, which did not appeal to me. I did not want to avert death and misery for others. I wanted you all to be miserable like I was. And I loved my neighbor as myself. I hated me and I hated you. And, you know, I thought I wanted good things for me, but I sure didn't want good things for you. You know, I had this limited idea of God. People oftentimes I hear say, I had this idea of a punishing God. I don't think I even had an idea of a punishing God. I was a punishing person. And the problem was, I thought God was like me. For years, I thought God was like me, which meant there was never enough, you know? And if she got a boyfriend, there wasn't going to be that one for me. And if you got a new job, that was meant I wasn't getting it. And if you had a lot of money, that took money out of my pocket somehow. I don't know how I thought that, but that's how I felt. I did not know there was enough for everyone. I didn't know he wanted us all to be happy. I'd come to these conventions and hear people talk from these podiums about how much better their life had gotten, and I hated them. I would cry and tell my sponsor, you know, why isn't that happening for me? And today I'm up here and it has happened for me, in spite of myself. That's another thing that was drummed into my head, Jeannie. Most of it's all going to be in spite of you. In spite of you, not because of you, in spite of you. I have fought this all the way. I would argue with my sponsor. One time he drew me a picture of a brain on a piece of paper. And you know how those signs are, he put a circle around it with a line through it. Don't think, Jeannie. I mean, I needed visual aids. Because I always was thinking about myself. It was just it was so boring. My children saved my life many times. When I got divorced, I never would have gotten out of bed again, I don't think, because I was scared to death. I had no God in my life, and you know, the person that I was relying on for everything was leaving. I treated him terribly. I was relying on him for everything. Years later, he drove down the street. I'd been sober for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. He drove down the street. The children were with me. I just moved into a house. A whole bunch of people from AA had helped me fix it up. They were all on the porch. The girls I sponsor were helping me move in. They were all on the porch. The idiot that I was running around with, buying guns, and I thought I was dating, but I wasn't, was on the porch. The babysitter that God had put in my life so that I had a babysitter every single night, my sponsor said, do not stay home and try to be a good mother. You do not know how. The nicest thing he could have done for my children, because if I had tried to stay home and be a good mother, when I did, it was not pretty. My daughter one time told me, you're too mean to be a mother. I said, you're right, but I'm yours. Anyway, we were all standing on this porch, and my ex-husband drives by, and he's waving and smiling, and I'm waving and smiling. And you know, I realized it took 30 people plus the entire fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to replace what I expected that man to do for me. You know, when I put the responsibility of somebody being God on another person, it's horrible for them, and it's horrible for me. Really, it's more horrible for them. He tried. I mean, he tried to babysit the children and rehab the house and bring home the money and be a lover and be a, you know, and date me and do all that stuff that I expected. But no human being can do all that, you know, at least not and have a good time. I always wanted to put that responsibility on one other individual. Now, I'd like to say that I learned that lesson and never did that again. There are many stories of me trying to do that again. One time I almost got myself to the psych ward. I bought a boat. I bought a $30,000 boat. Mortgaged that house, bought a $30,000 boat because I thought this guy and I were going to have a wonderful time on the Ohio River. He did have a wonderful time, but I wasn't on the boat at the time, I don't think. I was scared to death of this boat. There's a guy here today who taught me finally how to drive that boat before I got it, sold it. But I was ready for the psych ward by the time we got into this boat deal. I mean, I was driving down to this boat dock in the middle of the night, you know, checking the boat. I was terrified. I learned to pray myself to sleep during that time because it's the only way I could sleep because I had plans. I told you, when I've got plans, it is really hard work and serious business and scary. Self-reliance has failed me over and over again, and when I'm afraid, I know I'm probably counting on myself, or probably another human being, maybe a little bit too much. We got through that. My sponsor finally looked at me one day and said, Jeannie, you know better than this. And you know, I respected the man so much that when he said it, I thought, yeah. You know, I calmed down, and I stayed away from it, and I did get better. God will will do for me what I can't do for myself. We all talk about these obsessions we get into. I can't stop. I can't stop doing this. I can't stop doing that. And I, you know, when I finally get fed up enough and I get sick enough with it and get on my knees and I say, God, I do not care what you do. I don't care if he dies. I don't care if I die. I don't care if the nuclear war starts. I don't care what happens. Do something. He does it. I mean, the people that I think have been my problem when I'm doing that, when I'm obsessing about other people, they are literally removed from my life. I cannot get to them. I try to get to them again usually, but I mean, they won't open the door. They hang up the phone on me. They go to a bar that I was able to not go into a bar by then. I did know that if I went to the bar after him, what it probably meant was that I wanted to drink. And you know, that's what all those obsessions mean. I found out later. When there's something that I am just stuck on like that and I will not let it go, what I'm really telling you is I want to drink. I want to drink. I might not be thinking I want to drink, and I'm certainly not craving one because I haven't had one yet. But that's what those obsessions do. They lead me down that path to another drink. By the grace of God, those things were removed. The stuff that I haven't been able to do anything about. I've been fat and I've been thin. I remember telling this guy in my home group, these are the smallest pair of I've got the smallest pair of jeans on that I own. And he just looked at me real innocently and he said, is that good? I mean, after that I thought, I guess it doesn't matter if you're fat or thin. I mean, I really thought it mattered, you know. They were tight, but I had them on. And it turned out, you know, I mean, that's when I got divorced, when I was the thinnest I'd been in years, you know. My daughter, I brought this the first sponsor I had, never did the steps, I don't think. She told me to work with clay when it came time for the fourth step, but we weren't allowed to work with clay in my house because it messed up the house. So I never did work with clay, but she did take me out and buy me this dress to go to this first AA Thanksgiving banquet I went to. And I came down the hall with this dress on, and my daughter said, what is that thing around your waist? I said, it's a belt. I mean, you know, these kids really were distorted. I mean, this kid never saw a belt in her life. She was probably 10. Those kids, I mean, I would take them to school, and they'd have problems in school. And I would go to the conferences, and I guess I learned it from all of you. By then, I was with people who accepted me for who I was. You know, we would laugh about the fact we weren't hiding the fact that we were alcoholic, that we were distorted, that our thinking was strange, exaggerated, you know, that it wasn't exactly normal here, whatever normal is. And I would go to these conferences and they'd say, well, she's acting like this. And I'd say, well, they say they're afraid to, she's afraid to ask questions. I said, if I was your mother, you'd be afraid to ask questions too. I mean, you know, that's just the way it was. They'd say, he doesn't know his times tables. And I'd say right in front of him, I don't know mine either. I'm all right. I mean, you know, what do you need to know your times tables for? I worked in a bank. Hell, I didn't know my times tables. I still don't know them all, you know. I learned a trick with 9, but anything between 5 and 9 is iffy. These teachers did not understand this, you know. They wanted to put them on Ritalin. They were hyperactive. Well, Timmy was always underneath the furniture, and Jamie was always hanging on the teacher and wetting her pants. They wanted to put them on Ritalin, and I said, you know, we can do anything but that. I said, why would you want to teach these kids that have, like, a greater than 50-50 chance of being an alcoholic that pills are the solution to life? I wouldn't let them do it. I said, they have a mother problem. They do not have a hyperactivity problem. They have a mother problem. And it's worked out really well. Like I said, those kids have grown up and done great. Now, they don't do everything exactly the way I think they should, which causes me some disturbance. At times, my daughter, you know, I was telling Sally, today I usually am pretty peaceful a lot of the time. I don't wake up thinking about myself the minute that I open my eyes. I'm not terrified a lot. I would get really, really scared. I didn't know I was doing stuff to scare myself the whole time I was scared, but I was scared a lot. When I finally found out that the things I was doing were scaring me, I was able just to go do something else with you instead of doing what was scaring me. But when things happen in life, and there aren't very many of them is what I found out, most of the stuff that happens in my life is self-imposed. If it's bad, if it has a negative impact on me, it's bad. I had something to do with it. There are a few things that don't. But when those things happen, I do get scared. And my automatic response today is to redouble my spiritual efforts. And I don't know where that comes from, except I went to a meeting every single day, twice a day, for years and years and years. I don't like to be uncomfortable. I don't like it. I don't like that sick feeling in my stomach anymore. It went away, and I don't want it back. And when I do something or something happens in my life that's different, like we moved, and I had an experience where I did something that upset everybody, and me, and I was scared again, and I hated it. I was mad that I had this feeling again. Why did you just do, you know? But what I found out is life will keep going on, and a few things will happen that'll be tough like that. But I have a solution already. It's already in place. It's been in place because people that taught me, my sponsor, that he died a few years ago, but his last words to me were, "Stay happy, and find a brand new drunk to work with." That was neat. That was exciting to know that. Every time somebody has died in my family, I've either been at a conference, just went to one, or was going to one. I don't know how God does all that. He takes such perfect care of me. Nothing has ever been removed. That His loving hands weren't already there, taking care of me beforehand. My mother died from alcoholism. She taught me something so important that I hope I never forget it. Because if I do, you sure won't hear me speaking again. She died from alcoholism, and she was this really wonderful lady. She was a much better mother than I ever. Both my parents were great. And she was dying from alcoholism, and I remember seeing her in a hospital bed. And we had been going through the routine. Probably all of you have been through this either, you know, with someone that you've met in the program or with someone in your own family. And she's laying in the hospital bed one more time, and she was asleep. And I went in and I looked at her, and I'd been sober maybe 6 years, and I looked at her and I said, I didn't talk to her because she was sleeping. And I stood there and realized that she did not do that to herself on purpose. Up until that time, I kept thinking, she's my mother. Why isn't she being a better mother? You know, she doesn't love us. All that stuff that we think about ourselves, really. I mean, I thought I was thinking about other people. I was thinking it about myself. Why don't you care more? Why don't you try harder? Why aren't the things that are supposed to be important to you important to you? and I realized she didn't do that to herself on purpose. And at that moment, I think I understood that I was an alcoholic, that I'm an alcoholic, that I will drink again, whether I mean to or not, whether I want to or not, if I don't do something different. She had a chance at one point. Well, her chance was she couldn't swallow anymore. So she was mad about it, and she was telling me she couldn't swallow anymore, so now she couldn't drink her beer. We could only do the pills now. And I said, well, Mom, why don't you come to AA? But by then, she was so far gone, she couldn't go anywhere, really. And she said, well, I couldn't get to a meeting. I couldn't get that far. And I said, well, they'll come to you. Well, then the conversation ended. But I don't know why. I don't know why I've been given an opportunity that other people that are, I think, more deserving and better than I have never get. I fought with that for a long time. It says in the book stuff about cannot or will not. And I walked around AA for a long time, thinking that I knew who couldn't and who wouldn't. You won't, so I'm not talking to you. You're hell with you. And you can't, and you're very sad, but you know, you better go to the hospital. And I found out that I have no idea who can't and who won't. And I have no idea when that'll change. And that the only thing that gets between alcohol and somebody like me is God. No other human being. I learned that with all the people that I've worked with all the people I've tried to fix in AA, you know. I've gotten in between people and drinks. And you get hurt if you get it. I mean, one way or another, you get hurt if you get in between an alcoholic and what he wants to drink. And that was certainly true in my life. Anybody that got between me and a drink got hurt. And, you know, I don't think Alcoholics Anonymous here is here to get between people and drinking. But I do think that I need a lot of help in a spiritual way of living. I need a lot of help once that happens, once that intervention from God happens, that I need a lot of help to continue to grow in that. And that's what the fellowship does for me. And the steps continually do that for me. the first inventory I did, there was nothing about where I was at fault because I didn't think I was. And, you know, that didn't matter. I took the action that it said to take it to the best of my ability, which was pretty pathetic, but it worked. And I've taken many more since. And now, usually what comes to my mind first is where I'm at fault, which really ticks me off, because I would like to get angry sometimes and really have, you know, somebody to be resentful at. I got married about 4 years ago to a man who's in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been a trip. It's been a journey. It's been fun. He does Alcoholics Anonymous the same way that I was taught to do it. All out. It's the center focus of his life. He works with a lot of new people. He loves alcoholics. And I don't know that it gets any better than that, than to have the same, you know, primary purpose in your life. And we had our ups and downs. I mean, as soon as we got, I mean, we did really fine dating. By then I had learned all those horrible lessons and I was not going to do the same thing over again. And we did really fine dating. The minute that we moved in together, the minute we got married, I mean, I was doing the God thing again, you know, like, do you love me? Do you love me? Like, get out of my face. Go to a meeting. And then we would fight over the phone, and I was mad at his new guy. I mean, I'm just human, you know, and I do that stuff. I fall right back into it. But today, when I call my friends and tell them that stuff, they say, JD, the problem is you. Go to a meeting. My sponsor would say, pray, and if you need to talk to somebody about it, talk to Bob. That's my husband. I don't want to talk to him about it. So I go to a meeting and pray. Today that's still what we do. It's tremendous joy. Our children, a couple times recently, we have this big, huge, king-size bed because we found out we couldn't sleep in a queen-size bed because it was a little, I'm very set in my ways. I snore really loud, and he kicks all night, and I just wasn't working. We got this huge bed. Well, I found out why we got this huge bed. We paid way too much for it, but a couple times recently, these children, the 20-year-old, Bob's 20-year-old daughter lives with us, my 19-year-old daughter and my 16-year-old son. Now, they're huge. All of them are really tall. Well, Tracy's not really tall, but Timmy's 6'3". He was 1 year old when I got sober. You talk about it. If you want to know what happened, talk to him. Anyway, they all of a sudden, Bob will go back to lay down and watch television. Then one of them will go back, and then I'll go back. All five of us are in this king-size bed, laying on this king-size bed. And Bob and I are still the same way we were probably our whole lives, like, get out of here. I want to be alone. And the cat, even the cat comes and gets, and he, you know, it's like, this does not happen to people like me. I do not want to be around you. I went to meetings to get away from my children for years. They're why I'm sober, because I hated them. I wanted to go to a meeting. My mother would say that. My mother said that to me. She said, you know, the only reason you go to meetings is to get away from those kids. And she was right. But it got me there. And here we are with all these kids, and they love us, and they're happy. You know, my daughter is sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Tracy goes to Al-Anon. It's just been, this is what I heard from these podiums that I thought would never happen to me, you guys. You know, this is the stories I was hearing 10 years ago from people that have been sober for years and years and years, and God had turned their life around, and even the stuff that didn't work out the way that it's supposed to, or the way we all think it's supposed to, worked out better than you would ever think, and everything's okay. And life goes on, and you have operations, and you're sick, and you have money, and you don't have money, and you have cars that work, and you have cars that won't start, and you get flat tires, and you're fat, and you're thin, and you have a boyfriend, and you don't, and you have a husband, and you don't, and the kids act right, and they don't, and you know, all that stuff. Life happens, you know, but it doesn't matter. It's like it all matters, but it's like it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is that I'm here, I'm with all of you, and God is with all of us, and we just keep on going and do the best that we can today. So I think I'm done. Thank God. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks for asking me to talk. I didn't say that at the beginning. I don't think I meant to. It's a privilege. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.